I remember paging through, and on one page there would be like one cover would be about like John Cage. And you're like, what is a jazz magazine doing with John Cage? Like, what's going on there? And then there would be letters complaining about bossa nova inside. And then you'd turn the page and then there would be like Ornette Coleman. And so I remember really clearly going, oh my God, it was all happening at the exact same moment.
So one of my early fascinations in grad school was with how music's meaning changes as it travels. In many ways, this is a very obvious point. Of course, music would mean different things to different people as it moved through different cultures around the globe. But we, and by we I mean music scholars, but also listeners and fans, tend to get really hung up on origins, spending our time hunting down original meanings, favoring some early, seemingly fixed, authentic truth, instead of accepting that meaning is ever-changing, and sometimes a changed meaning turns out to be just as significant as the original. That idea might sound a little abstract, but it becomes really specific in the work of ethnomusicologist Caleb Goldschmidt, who is Associate Professor of Music at Wellesley College. Caleb's fascinating 2020 book, Bosso Mundo, examines what it means that bossa nova, despite being rooted in Brazilian culture, had a massive pop culture impact in the English-speaking world in the 1960s and beyond. They raise an important question. What does it mean when a national musical tradition moves into the global arena and becomes an exported commodity and even a brand? Our conversation today tackles this rich topic and what it means to research Brazilian music at this point in the country's history. I think you'll learn a lot, as I did, in speaking with Caleb Goldschmidt. So I want to start with an odd question because it's personal, but it's about me. But I think with your expertise, hear me out.
This is your podcast.
I think given your expertise, you'll have something useful to say about it, which is for the past few years, and I don't exactly remember when it started, my wife and I have regularly fallen asleep at night listening to Joao Gilberto play bossa nova, like some of the classic albums. And I'm just wondering, like, given what you make of that as a scholar of...
Wow.
Who examines the global circulation of Brazilian music and like and what it how its meaning changes in different mediations and audiences, like how that might resonate with your knowledge of bossa nova.
Well, can I ask which era of Joao you're listening to?
It's the album Amoroso, which I could not tell you the year because I just pulled up on Spotify.
So how that happened? Well, when I talked to somebody who works in bossa nova music for like ambient context. This is for an essay that has never been published because it's been stuck in an edited collection. I'm not going to complain about it too much, but I did do the research and talk to them. Yeah, well, they have like really smooth melodies and the accompaniment is nice and soothing. And so it works really well in ambient context. That is like the, and it's like a slow tempo, you know, moderate tempo. And also he has a really lovely voice. His voice is so soft. He really took advantage of microphone technology starting in the late 50s to like get really close and not shout, sing, not use that bel canto style that was really popular right before the bossa nova era. And so my guess is it has something to do with the instrumentation, right? Like probably it's guitar, acoustic guitar. They say in Portuguese, the violão, right? The violão, which has that really soft distillation of samba in it. But also like the melodies aren't that angular. They're pretty, they tend to be pretty predictable, especially if they are, even if they are on these like very dissonant chords, very complex chords, he tends to really hang out in a narrow range. You know, and so it's, I say this even though he's passed away some years ago now, but he had a really soothing voice. One of his songs that I absolutely adore, like love deeply to the point where I don't want to teach it because I don't want to have students say mean things about it. It's called Estu Se Ulyah. I love this song. And it's this super, super simple song. And like the lyrics just got me every time. Mm. And that's what does it for me. I speak Portuguese well enough to not have to look up translations of most of the words. And it's like this heartbreaking song of like longing and love. And his sweet, really soft voice just penetrates me. One of my claims to fame, is that I got to be quoted in the New York Times obit for when he passed away.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
It may have started around when he passed away, when I started listening to his music more, and then it was like, oh, this is nice. This is nice sleepy time music. But obviously we're experiencing this music differently because I'm experiencing it through this kind of mediated American market as ambient music, right? And you're experiencing it as more connected to perhaps its kind of Brazilian roots, so to speak. Like, you talked about the sound, but like, what about how it ends up that this is a kind of music that an American listener might listen to differently than, let's say, a Brazilian listener in 1960 or now?
Yeah, like 1962 and 1964 were the really, really big moments. And it was just, it penetrated so deeply into American pop culture, like so deeply. It's extraordinary how quickly the history forgets that this happened. And part of the reason why I think we forget is because the Beatles happened right after, right? Like it's like Bossa Nova than the Beatles, right?
Okay.
And I think how deeply this music just went everywhere. And it was so closely linked to cool jazz. And it was also linked to like early 1960s dance fads.
Mm.
That it really just went all over the place and that eventually became tied to like sexy spy movies, right? Which is why I wrote that chapter, because it still keeps on popping up in those contexts. If you watch film and television, it's just kind of relentless from where I'm sitting, like, wow, this music became sex music. And I think that moment when it got overplayed, became associated with easy listening, is when it became the ambient music. I think that's how it got there.
Right.
But it's the whole thing that motivated me to do the project was trying to show people this is Brazilian music. You know this. Like, I will say to people, oh yeah, I wrote a book about Brazilian music and American and British media cultures. And they'll say like, that's a very niche topic. And I'm like, yeah, the reason why I wrote it is because you know this music and you just don't know that that's what it is.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's really quite, it's everywhere. And I will be like in a movie and suddenly Bossa Nova will play and I'm like, you know, there it is. Or watching television. My mom got to a point where she started to recognize Bossa Nova music and she would like, hey, watch this TV show after the first, you know, there's a Brazilian song in it, you know, and like, okay. But I remember when I was writing the book, I was writing my dissertation, which was the foundation for two of the chapters in the book. I went and saw the movie Closer with my then partner. And there's this scene where Bebel Gilberto is basically performing in the movie. And I'm like, how are people not talking about the fact that this is in this movie? You know? And I kept on thinking I would do something else. And the topic just kept bringing me back. And I'm like, ugh, you know, because I am a bit tired of it, to be honest with you. You know, I started the project literally like 19 years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I feel, I started it during my first year of my PhD, and I started tinkering with Brazilian music as a topic in 2002. So it's been a very long time.
Yeah. I want to get back to your personal trajectory, but let's talk a little bit about that moment in the early 60s. So like, how does Bossa Nova kind of originate in Brazil and grow the momentum such that it becomes this kind of global phenomenon?
It originates among wealthy and middle-class white folks hanging out in the wealthiest neighborhoods of Rio. Like, it is mostly a reaction to the overwrought, hyper-dramatic style of samba song or samba canção that started with the Golden Age, so like 1930s. But it really got to be overbearing, some people thought, by the 1950s. And then after Getúlio Vargas took his life, and he was like a strong man, political figure. He was at one point a dictator, and he was elected president. There were many revolutions and new constitutions when he was in charge. And he's the guy who established the samba drum. So we're recording this on Ash Wednesday. And the significance of that is not lost on me, because yesterday was the last day of Carnival. And if you look on social media, you'll see like all of this evidence of what samba has meant to the national imaginary ever since the 1930s. And so you have this like samba is Brazilian culture thing that starts to happen. It becomes part of how international soft power works for the country. And it's a really big part of tourism and all these things, like really, really important. It gets appropriated by the state. What was once a persecuted or marginalized musical community becomes the main show, right? Mm. And so that happens in the 1930s. And in the 1950s, after Vargas takes his life, Kubitschek is elected. And he's this, you know, Juscelino Kubitschek. And he has this big plan to like heal the country, to modernize the country, to make it cosmopolitan. And there's a very wry expression, I would say. It's been said as always the country of the future, or Brazil is the country of the future and always will be.
I see. Right?
Like, right. Meaning that it's never quite getting there. Like it's always in this forever subjugated position with like tremendous potential, right? And you see this in a number of South American countries where they, especially like Argentina and Brazil, both think that they should be as big as, say, France. And both of them have difficulty getting to that status. But with Brazil, like you think about the landmass of it, and you think about the extraordinary resources and how much has been invested in it from foreign investors. And it never gets to this point of being like a liberal democracy that is stable.
Right.
We have it like, you know, everybody's very happy that, you know, the democracy is still functional at the moment, but it's also got a lot of corruption, right? A lot of weird stuff goes on there. But when Kubitschek was elected, he promised to do 50 years of progress in 5 years. And when that was happening, it was really exciting because the government was spending ridiculous amounts of money. They had like an auto plant in the country. They were getting like a lot of investment and just ridiculous spending. He moved the capital from Rio de Janeiro to the interior of the country, to Brasilia. But there was just ridiculous amounts of optimism for the middle classes. And there's been a lot of discussion of like, well, bossa nova is a product of that moment, right? Like, this, let's sing love songs, let's talk about technology, let's use jazz. Let's use jazz harmonies and harmonies that come from French modernism to move away from this like very limited musical vocabulary that samba has towards this like very quote unquote sophisticated cosmopolitan orientation. And you can see that with the ways that some of the musicians called what their names were, right? Like Antonio Carlos Jobim, the really famous composer of this era, his nickname is Tom or Tom, right? There's another really important singer, his name is Dick Farney, right? Like they're adopting names that come from like jazz culture from the United States. And they love Frank Sinatra and Chet Baker. Like they really, really adore these men who sing with soft vocals. And so they're listening to jazz. And Nat King Cole, they like him too. But they are really focused on like the vocal varieties of cool jazz and like post-World War II pop jazz vocals, right? But as they bring samba and this aesthetic together, it is kind of it's an experiment. They don't know that it's going to work. A lot of people talk about from like the United States and from Western Europe. They talk about like Black Orpheus as being the beginning of bossa nova, but Brazilians are like, no. Like, that is not right. Bossa nova starts with Chega de Saudade. No more, in the US, it's called No More Blues. But like, as that film adaptation of a stage play was being put together, these musicians were experimenting with the techniques that would become bossa nova. The one thing that's missing is Joao Gilberto's style of singing. Mm-hmm. So when you listen to that soundtrack, it's like this very like quasi-operatic style of singing, right? If you listen to it, you're like, whoa, like, what is this? The guitars sound familiar, you know, and the harmonies sound familiar, the lyrics sound familiar, but you're missing that one piece. But it's coming from this like international orientation, middle class, wealthy, people hanging out in Nara Leão's apartment, looking at the coast. But then it catches on when Joao Gilberto records Chega de Saudade with the recording producer was the same guy who was in Carmen Miranda's band that toured the US, and he was involved with like adapting Samba to Disney shorts. And so he had a really like worldly view on what to do with this music, had, but that is where it came from. This song went on the radio and it was this huge fad, and all of these musicians joined, like followed Joao Gilberto, Antonio Carlos Jobim, Vinicius mm-hmm. de Moraes. Like those were the really big important originators, and there was this huge group of people who followed along. And bossa nova as it developed really changed in sound. Some of it, there was like a hard bossa nova style, which is where Sergio Mendes came from. It's where Elmer Deodato came from, and it's this much more brass heavy like sound. And a lot of folks don't know that that's bossa nova. Like, it's like, yeah, like if you look at like what people were calling it, like it's this very big corpus of music. And most of the earliest recordings are really highly orchestrated. Like you listen to that and you hear like French horn and flute and like sometimes a string section. And the way that it gets reimagined in the United States, like if you think about the Stan Getz and Joao Gilberto album, there's none of that, right? It's as like pared down as possible. And if you look at when Charlie Byrd and Stan Getz did their album, that adaptation is very weird. Like I, as somebody who listens to too much bossa nova, listening to what happened in the first wave of bossa nova recordings in the US, it just is really, really weird compared to what was happening in Brazil. Right. And it's almost like they fetishized the rhythm and Joao Gilberto's guitar and the melodies and harmonies, and they forgot about everything else. Or if you think about, or if you think about this the way that jazz musicians think about texts, right? Oh yeah, they like the tune and they did it their way.
Right.
But because they like the tune and did it their way, there's all of this stuff that's just missing or misunderstood. But it didn't take me very long of spending time in Brazil to figure out just how different this, the recordings there were versus what happens here.
So you mentioned kind of the this landing right before the Beatles, and it seems like in some way there's kind of like an analog to be made of Beatlemania, of like you have this group not from the U.S. absorbing musical styles from the U.S. and then becoming famous locally and then bringing that back into the U.S. So like what is that moment when this music touches down in the U.S., what is its relationship to cool jazz? How does it become this cultural phenomenon here?
The Kennedys.
Okay.
I think Jackie Kennedy in particular, and her way of being sophisticated and what that looked like, what that sounded like. I like the timing of when it falls, right? When bossa nova fades. Right after Kennedy gets assassinated. Like it's like the timing of all of this is just really overwhelming. Like once you start looking at the larger context, and with US jazz, you know, we're in the moment when free jazz is starting, right? Like when I was looking at the reception of this stuff, right? I'm flipping through pages of, I did my research mostly whenever I could, flipping through pages of old magazines, right? Like I would sit in the library for days, weeks. But the first stage of research was looking, I wrote the first chunk of the book that ends up staying in the book for a seminar that I took with Tim Taylor. And I remember spending like 3 weeks in the library just paging through old downbeats because I was convinced something was missing. And I knew I wanted to do Brazilian music as a topic for my dissertation. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I remember paging through, and on one page, there would be like one cover would be about like John Cage. And you're like, what is a jazz magazine doing with John Cage? Like, what's going on there? And then there would be letters complaining about bossa nova inside. And then you turn the page, and then there would be like Ornette Coleman. And so I remember really clearly going, oh my God, it was all happening at the exact same moment.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And it's not that different from like when people talk about like the year 1959 in jazz, just in terms of how thick that moment was. Right. There's like even documentaries about this. Like, yeah, you had like Take Five and Mingus and all of this stuff happening at the exact same moment.
We often kind of view it instead as like, okay, here was bebop and then cool jazz and then modal jazz and then free jazz. But in fact, all of these things were often happening at the exact same time.
At the exact same kind of blue, at the exact same moment, Mingus exact same moment as Shape of Jazz to Come. Right. They're all happening around the same moment while John Cage is doing his thing. And the jazz press and jazz musicians were paying attention to all of it at the same time. That's one thing. Second thing, I have talked to jazz musicians and I have talked to old fans of this music. And the way they describe it is this gave you a way to appreciate music that wasn't from white people in the United States without having to confront the racial tensions that were all over jazz at the time.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
So it gave people this like escape hatch. And I am not going to excuse that. Like some of the men I talked to just like lusted after Astrid Gilberto, or they wanted to have makeout music in their college dorms or whatever. But the the way that they talk about, oh yeah, this gave us something to do that was different, that nobody was going to say we were bad about civil rights or we were bad about race and jazz, right? This is the same period when like Amiri Baraka is calling out jazz critics, mm-hmm. when Abby Lincoln, there's like this jazz and race like fixation that starts to show up in the press. And like Ingrid Monson has published about this in her book, Freedom Sounds, of like just how intense the debate was. And I had seen much of the same stuff when I was looking at it, and I was going to publish about it. And then I read Ingrid's book and I was like, well, don't have to do that. Thanks, Ingrid. But like, it's all there. Like the jazz critics were suddenly realizing that they were complicit. People like John Hammond were being called out and like, well, he did some good stuff, but also look at this problem here. And all of these critics, like Gene Lees, Nat Hantoff, were being taken to task for having terrible racial politics, right? And they're responding to bossa nova. They are writing about it. They're trying to champion Antonio Carlos Jobim. They're complaining about the function of money and how quickly all of these jazz musicians jumped on the bandwagon. And this is the same moment when like Amiri Baraka is screaming about how quickly jazz has left its avant-garde roots behind and gone towards this much more popular version of jazz. It's happening at the same moment. And it's a problem, but also people really like it.
Right.
You know, people really like it because it's giving people a way to get out of this tension that has taken over or was starting to become noticeable, right? In the ways that jazz musicians were becoming more outspoken, as they should have been.
Yeah. And so this is also, I mean, what people are liking is Stan Getz and Gilberto recording together. Like, that's right. That's the moment where this really hits in the U.S.
And they're liking Quincy Jones. Mm-hmm. Reducing this and turning out like this soul bossa nova, and they're liking, mm-hmm. you know, Zoots. Like they're liking Herbie Mann. They're liking, they're liking a lot of this stuff. They're liking Cannonball Adderley doing this.
Sure.
They it's really quite varied, and it by far the most financially successful. The person who capitalized the most off of this, without any debate, is Stan Getz. Like he really rode that train as far as it would take it, take him rather. And, you know, at a certain point, he confessed that he was tired of playing it. But did he ever, did he kept on putting out these albums, right?
So what did Brazilian listeners and musicians make of the kind of contextual transformation of this music as it becomes this phenomenon outside of Brazil?
I can't speak for everybody, obviously. I can speak to what I have heard people say to me
The
context. I once watched a documentary about this in my Portuguese class when I was attending PUC Rio, which is the Catholic University in Rio de Janeiro. And I remember the way they talked about it was like, isn't this funny? Right? Like, isn't this funny that the Americans are dancing to this music? This doesn't make any sense. But bossa nova was a massive fad in Brazil before it was a massive fad in the United States and the UK. So they had like bossa nova TV sets and like bossa nova rugs and all these things. And in the US, bossa nova haircuts, bossa nova cashmere sweaters. Like it was similar on that level. Ah, fad. We understand the fad thing happened in both places, but what it looked like and what people did were different. Right. One of them is like hyper intellectual, sophisticated. We are arriving on the world stage. Yay. Mm-hmm. The other one is like, look at this weird thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So this moment is kind of representative of a number of histories that you tell in the book from this kind of beginning around this period and going forward of kind of how Brazil, what it means for Brazil to kind of promote itself globally through its music.
Yeah.
Can you kind of the talk about
brand. Yeah.
That idea that of music as a national brand and what that means in Brazil, particular, kind of in a broader way?
Sure. I mean, in Latin America, in particular, music has been really important to promoting countries internationally. So, like mambo in Cuba, right? Like really important tango or tango in Argentina, really important to the national, the way that the country tries to assert some power or leverage with international investors, right? With mambo, like it was an attraction for people on the East Coast of the United States to come down and party in Cuba. For tango, it was like really fixed in and becomes a high ballroom style in Paris before it comes back. And suddenly it becomes celebrated. It goes from being the music of brothels to the music of like high class trendy people, right? And so this is the context. You have this history of music in Latin America being defined by Europe and the United States. And Pablo Palomino, the invention of Latin American music. Like, and you see this like as being an important way that the most powerful countries engage with what's going on in South America and with Mexico and the Caribbean. And so Brazil figures out really fast, the country, the government figures out really fast that samba can be used for soft power, meaning that it can increase goodwill, increase willingness to invest. And when we talk about the nation brand, right, it starts to become a thing that is really important on the global stage during the lead up to World War II, sure, and after and afterwards. And so with samba and then bossa nova, this is music that is really closely tied to a national identity that through a process of curation and you could say refinement or whitening or, you know, all kinds of processes that go into samba becoming what it is and that go into it becoming a commodity and that can be promoted abroad, that people can make money off of, that can go into why somebody like Orson Welles would want to film a documentary in Brazil, right? Like the very idea that you have this association of Brazil is that land that has that dance, that has that music, that has beautiful beaches. And all of those things get heightened with bossa nova. Ah, this is music that's singing about pretty people on the beach, singing about love on the beach. And so, especially through France, but and England, but a lot of European countries like Italy too, Spain, Portugal, they really, really like Germany, what's coming out of Brazil and what's coming out of South America. And they start to invest in, say, filming movies there or in selling products there, right? So the soft brand becomes tied to revenue and investment. And Bossa Nova has been tied to Brazil's national brand ever since Black Orpheus won the Oscar for best foreign language film, right? Like it is, like it has had this power, even though Black Orpheus wasn't a Brazilian film, because it took place there and there was this musical style very close to what ends up becoming Bossa Nova. There's this linkage.
I see.
And it allows the country to say, aha, we are a racial democracy. We have such good relations between the races that we can have this music that is taking from European and European styles like French modernism and taking from jazz. Look, that's how cool we are. Mm-hmm. We've got it down and everybody loves this music. You should too. Come and give us money.
Right.
And so it becomes really closely linked to the identity of Rio de Janeiro, and Rio de Janeiro becomes basically the postcard in a sense for what Brazil is to the rest of the world.
Yeah. So how does that relate to this kind of, you mentioned whitening and like, and also how when Bossa Nova is received in the US, it allows white jazz critics to not have to think about US race, issues of race. So like how does this discussion of music as a national brand kind of intersect with discourses of race in Brazil or contradict or, yeah.
I'm going to try this slowly. So, okay. Samba. Music associated with Afro-Brazilians, right? It comes from candomblé, mixing it up with like music of the street. And it also mixes up with people who were classically trained. So like samba is music that is of Afro-Brazilians. It is associated with the favelas. It's associated with migrants coming down to Rio de Janeiro from the Northeast, specifically Salvador da Bahia. So it's this music that is very, very Black. Right. It becomes a national style through political intervention, right? Through Getúlio Vargas. And all but a handful of the musicians associated with Bossa Nova are white or light-skinned. There were some who were not. Bola Seche, I write about him in the book, but there were some others. Elisete Cardoso, who was the singer of the first recording of Chega de Saudade, she was a mulata or a mixed-race woman, right? So there were some important figures in all of this who weren't white, but the most powerful figures were. João Gilberto, he was from the Northeast, right? He had lighter skin, but he definitely was mixed race, right? But you have like Antonio Carlos Jobim and Vinicius de Moraes being these like very white dudes who have most of the power in the genre. They're getting all the publishing rights. Most of the publishing rights. And they are these like standard white Brazilian dudes. And like there are a lot of them in the country who were extremely talented, who were extremely open-minded towards race, but they have a European sensibility on terms of what the lyrics are supposed to do and what the harmonies are supposed to do. So it does become whitened in that way. But I'm trying to complicate it's only whitened. It's just really dominated by this white aesthetic. And when Vinicius de Moraes publishes or writes the liner notes, he calls himself the poet of the lyrics, right? He's asserting the power of what he's doing. Mm. And I mean, there are all of these indications that like purely instrumental versions of Bossa Nova just don't do as well. They don't sell as well. It's only the vocal music that does well, that has this reputation. And most of the music scholars in Brazil continue to be in departments of letters, right? Like, so the music is really treated like as really elevated literature in a way, like in this country, like in cultural studies departments or literature departments, we pretend that we do that. It's not like what happens in Brazil.
I see. It's kind of like Bob Dylan studies in the US or something.
Right. So take Bob Dylan studies and expand it out to all of the important lyricists after World War II.
Okay. Yeah. Huh. So kind of returning to your trajectory, how did you end up spending 19 years working on Brazilian music? How did you get into this?
How did I get into it?
How did you get in deeper and deeper? Yeah.
So like most kids trying and failing to play jazz in high school, I played a lot of bad bossa nova. And this was around the period right after Antonio Carlos Jobim died. And so there was a lot of access to recordings of bossa nova in record stores at that time. I'm a bit older than you. I don't know how much, but I know I am. But I, like, in high school, you know, I would go to Warehouse Music and there would be these displays of CDs. And I remember specifically the first time I bought something that had bossa nova on it was in the lead up to Father's Day of my junior year of high school. So we're talking 1996. I bought, that ages me, but I bought a Stan Getz like compilation. And I remember the moment when I heard, there were two recordings that were from the Getz Gilberto sessions. It was the longer non-radio version of Girl from Ipanema and Corcovado.
Okay.
Right? And I remember just fixating on those and thinking the rest of it was terrible. And it's probably because I was hearing a lot of bossa nova elsewhere. I am sure of it. But it was my first time encountering the song Girl from Ipanema. I went on this like tour of Israel because I was a Jewish kid growing up in Southern California that summer. And one of the kids on that tour was a Brazilian Jew. And he used to sing the lyrics of Girl from Ipanema in Portuguese to me because he knew it made him cool. So like that is this like really important early moment for me. I remember like trying to play the Jamie Abersol books on Jobim's music. I was terrible. Okay. I could not
get the rhythm. What was your instrument?
Right. Trumpet. Trumpet and bass.
Everyone bass wants to hear that. Gilberto on high school trumpet. Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah, it's terrible. And then skip forward to the end of my undergraduate years. I took a seminar on Brazilian music. It was not a very successful class, but I became obsessed with the music in that class. The professor or the instructor of the course gave us like tapes of the music because he couldn't figure out how to use the streaming platform that we had. So this is 2001. The streaming was terrible. Like, they used like Real Media or something. Yeah, I remember it was just awful. So buffering. He just was like, give me, He was like, give me a tape. I will make you a mix of all of the music. And I remember I used to drive evening vans around UCLA, right, from like the various parts of campus to the parking lots. And I would just listen to this music. And not all of it was bossa nova. An awful lot of it was like MPB music. And I just loved it. And I remember going to, after that course was over, I graduated, I finished my undergrad, and I somehow managed to get a good grade in the class, even though I thought I was terrible at it. And I remember thinking, huh, if I love this music in spite of what I think was unsuccessful teaching, this is something to pay attention to, right? Because when we're undergraduates, or when we're teaching undergraduates and we're charismatic professors or we're having a good day and somebody falls in love with the music, that is what, that's kind of a normal experience, right? If we're having a terrible day or a terrible semester or a terrible quarter, whatever system we're in, and the student falls in love with the music, that's a bit different. And that's what happened to me, right? It wasn't a very good class for me. Like I remember struggling the whole time, like having seriously bad feelings about the instructor, but also loving the music. So I couldn't hate the instructor. I just thought, wow, this is a bad class.
Sure.
But I loved the music. And, you know, I ran into him a few years after that class and I was like, that class changed my life. He was like, it was such a bad class. I'm so sorry you were in it. So like, he knew it didn't work out, but I still was like, whoa, I want to learn Portuguese. Went to grad school, UC San Diego. I went there to work with George Lewis before he left. And I remember the first term I did a project on Carmen Miranda, but I didn't speak a word of Portuguese. And everybody was like, well, you can learn Portuguese later. And I was like, okay. But I was like fixated on like, tell me how I can do this. And I realized I had to write a master's thesis. So I did something else for a while because there was no way I was going to learn Portuguese in time to do a thesis, right? Mm-hmm. You only have 2 years to do a master's. There's no way. Went to UCLA, saw the Assad brothers play at Royce Hall my second term of UCLA. for my PhD. And I was like, damn it, I need to learn this music. I applied for a FLAS grant. I got it. I learned Portuguese.
So we haven't really talked about, you know, you talked about kind of the presidential administrations leading up to Bossa Nova, but, you know, your book came out in 2019, which is the same year that Bolsonaro was elected. We're speaking a few months after he was fortunately ousted by Lula. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the last few years have affected Brazilian music, but also how they've affected your own understanding of the work that you're doing and also your own abilities to do scholarly work in and around Brazil.
So I'll start with the depressing stuff first, which was, I don't think I can go back to Brazil for a while. The Bolsonaristas, they're not gone. You know, Lula won, but he didn't win by that much. And so me being trans means that I don't feel safe, right? I'm just like, no, I can't go. I have friends who are much more comfortable dealing with it, like gay friends. But people who are intellectuals, people who are Black or who speak about Black rights or racial rights in Brazil, people who believe that gender is not necessarily what you are assigned with at birth, are not safe. Academics have been, during his administration, it was dangerous for them to hold their jobs. I knew people who were trying to leave.
Wow.
And so as a scholar who fell in love with Brazilian culture, like, it was intense. Like, I dedicated, you know, many decades, I would say, like more than a decade, almost two, to working with the music from that country. The day that I woke up and found out he was going to be president, it felt like really intense heartbreak.
Wow.
Like, I felt it physically. I remember it was in my body and I was like, God. And like every Brazilianist I knew, we were all like, what are we going to do? You know, so I decided that it wasn't safe for me to go back. And so I had to come up with other ways to occupy myself. But there was still plenty of hope coming from certain segments of the population, right? So somebody who I am really proud has gotten as much attention as she has is an artist named Liniker, L-I-N-I-K-E-R. She won the Grammy for Best MPB Album, I believe. And she's a trans woman. And she, you know, before, right when I was finishing my book, she like had a Tiny Desk concert on NPR. Like, she's a big deal. And, you know, she and a bunch of other trans artists were suddenly doing really well. I work for a journal. I'm a co-editor for a journal called JOP, the Journal of Popular Music Studies. And we have an article coming out in the summer that's all about another trans artist. This one's Pipita. And like, we're seeing this flourishing of very bold trans artists being very popular. Gender nonconforming artists. There's one named Pablo Vittar, who I write about in my book. But they're like household names. Like, everybody knows who they are. They're doing really well. And early into Bolsonaro's administration, some of the top hip hop artists were releasing songs that were very clearly coded as gay, even though they are themselves not. Like, they were trying to assert some sort of allyship. And that gives me a lot of hope because, you know, when you have a country like Brazil that is on the surface very liberal around sexuality, but in practice really isn't, seeing that kind of outpouring of support, public support, is really hopeful. So I am really happy about that bit. Like, I wish that I was more comfortable taking the risk to go there. I just don't want to deal with like dealing with my passport. Like, what's going to happen when I go through the passport line? Because the people who are running security or like at the border checkpoint, like, how many of them were supporting Bolsonaro? When you look at what happened with the protests that happened in Brazil in early January, that looked a lot like what happened here in this country. It's scary, to say the least, because a lot of the police just let it happen, because the Bolsonaro protesters raided government buildings having to do with all three branches of government. And I'm like, they trashed the place. What gives me hope is that there was a crackdown on everybody right away. So people got arrested right away. Whereas in this country, we don't really have much of, in comparison, we don't see that same kind of swiftness of stopping this. But I am depressed about it. I'm feeling more hope, but you know, for the last 4 years, I was like, well, I guess I have to do other things, you know, because I can't be going. And you know, I found other things to do, and I found a new project to work on that I'm excited to work on. But I'm not done with Brazil. I keep on trying to be, but I cannot. I keep on trying. It's impossible. But you know, with music, it is one of the most diverse musical countries in you can imagine, right? Like, there's this really great queer sertanejo singer named Gabeo, and he's really hilarious and fun, and he has a good Instagram account and a good TikTok, and he like tells funny stories, and he's doing really well. Like, he's on all of these big playlists that are for Brazilian versions of our streaming services. Like, he's like a big deal. Queer Nejo. There was a whole feminist movement of the most conservative genre, that sertanejo style, that's called Feminejo, right? Like, and it's like, that is giving me so much hope. Like, wow, look at this. Like, we don't have the language in the United States to describe quite what this is like. It would be like, you know how in the US we have like alt country?
Sure.
Imagine if the alt country people actually took over country radio.
Wow. Yeah.
Imagine how powerful that would be. Well, that kind of thing is happening with Sertanejo. Really, really hopeful. And if I were still working on Brazilian music full time, that would be the thing I'd want to work on, because there's just so much energy and enthusiasm around it. Right. Gabeo was nominated for a Latin Grammy for Best Sertanejo Album. He didn't win, but he got to go, and he was very happy to be there. And he's this small guy from the interior who like puts out these hilarious songs about like sugar daddies and stuff. And it's just really, really amazing. And it's not the kind of stuff that makes international news around pop music changes, right? But it also gives me so much hope, because it's like, look at this. This is the most conservative part of the country, and that's the music that has the most traction right now. And increasingly young people in Brazil, even in the most wealthy parts, so people from Sao Paulo and Rio, like this music. They see it as being less constrained than the music that is based off of samba.
Right.
This is the music that speaks to them more, you know?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Many thanks to Caleb Goldschmidt for that deep conversation. You could read more about their work on our website, soundexpertise.org. Our inbox is, again, open. If you have questions or thoughts about the show or anything else you want to say, email us at soundexpertise00@gmail.com or tag me on Twitter or Instagram at Seated Ovation. I'm grateful to D. Edward Davis for his production work. You can check out his music on SoundCloud at Warm Silence. And many thanks to Andrew Del Antonio for transcribing our episodes to make them more accessible. This episode of Sound Expertise was recorded at the National Foreign Language Center with support from University of Maryland's School of Music. Next week on Sound Expertise, the deeply fascinating musical life of Joshua Rifkin.
Through a long series of accidents, which I needn't bore you with, that led to the formation of the Even Dozen Jug Band. This is in the summer of 1963. Again, by the way, the same summer in which I was on another night playing the first performance of Satie's Vexations.